There is a war going on for your mind. Media mavens mount surgical strikes from trapper keeper collages and online magazine racks. CoverGirl cutouts throw up pop-up ads infecting victims with silicone shrapnel. Worldwide passenger pigeons deployed paratroopers. Now it's raining pornography. Lovers take shelter. Post-production debutantes pursue you in NASCAR chariots. They construct ransom letters from biblical passages and bleed mascara into the holy water supplies. There is a war going on for your mind. Industry insiders slang test tube babies to corporate crackheads. They flash logos and blast ghettos. Their embroidered neckties say, stop snitching. Conscious rappers and whistleblowers get stitches made of acupuncture needles and marionette strings. There is a war going on for your mind. Professional wrestlers and vice presidents want you to believe them. The desert sky is their blue screen. They superimpose explosions. They shout at you. Pay no attention to the men behind the barbed curtain, nor the craters beneath the draped flags. Those hoods are there for your protection, and the medias these days are the size of corpses. There is a war going on for your mind.
We are the insurgents.
That was Flobots with There's a War Going On for Your Mind. And you're listening to Beneath the Surface with Michael Slate. Welcome to the show today. I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. And we got a packed show today. There's actually what we're talking about here. There is a war going on for your mind. There's a war going on for your mind in every aspect. And today's show is going to concentrate on that, fighting that war, fighting back in that war. In the back end of the show, we're going to be talking about police brutality, police murder. We're going to be talking about how Black and Latino people face this every day of their lives, from the moment they're born till the moment that they go down underground. That's what we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking about with Carl Dix, from the Revolutionary Communist Party. We're going to be talking about October 22nd, the National Day of Protest Against Police Brutality, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation. We're also going to be joined by a member of the Los Angeles October 22nd Coalition. His name is Age, and he'll be joining us a little bit later in the show. But before we get into all that, we're going to be listening to a speech from P.Z. Myers. P.Z. is one of the foremost fighters and defenders of evolution in the world today. His blog is one of the most popular science blogs, if not the most popular science blog in the world today. And you can actually access that by, the easiest way to do it is by Googling Pharyngula. That's Pharyngula. And that'll take you to his website. Or just Google P.Z. Myers. You're really up for a treat on that one. And P.Z. actually is going to be a regular part of this show in the future. He's going to have a monthly column with us. He's going to sit in every month and just talk about critical issues of the day. Without any further ado, we're going to get into P.Z. Myers speaking to the Atheist Alliance International Convention in Burbank in the earlier part of October. And this is a very passionate, very well-constructed, very, very, very strong debunking of intelligent design.
Please welcome Professor P.Z. Myers.
Okay, wow, what a crowd. I was told I have to warn you something, and that is that this talk has to end at 5:45 because they're going to dismantle the rooms and they're going to throw you out. But that's not what's going to get you out of here. Anyway, 5:45 is when they start serving beer outside. Yes. So I kind of expect that no matter what I do, the audience is going to go poof right at 5:45. Okay, well, what I want to do today is I want to talk about a very common issue in dealing with intelligent design creationists. Their most common argument, basically their only argument. And I suspect that most of you have not attended one of their lectures. I have, unfortunately. I've listened to Michael Behe and Dembski and John West and Stephen Meyer and all these people from the Discovery Institute that are cruising around giving their talks. And so what I thought I would do, since you probably haven't heard them all, is I would give you their lecture first. So I'm going to give you a condensed version of an intelligent design creationist lecture. It'll be very entertaining. Complexity, 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 complexity. Oh, look, there's a pathway. It's very complicated. Complexity, 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 complexity. And did you know that cells are really, really complicated? But we're not done. Complexity, 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 complexity. And you're going to be blown away by the bacterial flagellum. It's like a little machine, and it's really, really complicated. Complexity, complexity, complexity. Complexity. We need more cells. They're really complicated. You just get blown away by these things. They are so amazingly complicated. Complexity. Therefore, design. You've heard it all now. That's the root of their argument. Isn't that really complicated? Wow. How could that come to be? Let me summarize it a little bit more succinctly. The core of their argument is this, that complexity can only be created by design. That's the first premise they offer up. And then what they do in their lectures is they tell you over and over again, biology is really complex. And then that means biology was created by design. Now, I suspect there's a few philosophers out there in the audience. If you ever want to teach your students about the fallacy called begging the question, send them to the Discovery Institute webpage. That's what it is. This is a big exercise in circular logic in begging the question. So what I want to do here today is I want to address this premise. Complexity can only be created by design. It's not true, first of all, and there's a couple reasons why it's not true. One is, first of all, the fact that they have to use a logically untenable argument to advance their case is kind of an argument against their story. The other thing is that what they are doing is they're reducing this whole complicated story. I use the word complicated. It is a complicated story. They're reducing it to an argument by metaphor. Metaphors are useful for getting across basic concepts to people, but they're not the foundation of a strong logical argument. And finally, I want to mention that what they're going to be doing when they make these arguments is they're going to be implying a lot of straw man claims about modern biology. And basically what they do is they parasitize actual research that's been done in the field. So let me push this a little further and talk about this metaphor. You know, you're used to seeing the Discovery Institute. And the Discovery Institute, as most of you may know, is very careful to remove themselves from any discussion of God. They don't want to get tangled up in that religion issue. And so they tend to put this secular front up in front of themselves, at least in their public pronouncements, though privately they mostly seem to be evangelical and fundamentalist Christians. But this argument can also be found somewhere else. Our favorite creationist, Ray Comfort, uses this same argument, this argument from design. This is from his book, You Can Lead an Atheist with Evidence, but You Can't Make Him Think, typical Ray Comfort. And you can see the gist of his story here. He's saying that every building has a builder, every painting has a painter, therefore, everything has a creator. There's a problem with that argument, right? I hope you can see it. What this is simply arguing from an overextended metaphor, and it's the same thing that the Discovery Institute does when they show you bacterial flagellum. So they're making this silly argument about buildings and painters and whatever strikes their fancy, and making this conclusion that every design has a designer, but my answer is, and this must mean that every single thunderbolt must have a thunderer. You can't stop a runaway metaphor. There's no brakes on it. So we can just say anything we want. So this is, again, a logical fallacy. Making this kind of ridiculous argument for metaphor does not advance the cause in any scientific or rational sense, but it's the one they make over and over again, and it doesn't matter whether you're Ray Comfort or Michael Behe, they're doing exactly the same thing. Now, the other thing I have to point out here is their argument is fairly silly, and it's relying on biological evidence, right? Nobody would argue with them when they say biology is complicated. I teach biology. I flunk students every year. So I know this, that it's hard to get some of these concepts across to them. Unfortunately, what that means is that they're in an uncomfortable position. If they're saying that looking at all this complicated stuff necessarily implies design, why is it that all those biologists out there are doing this research, who are doing the actual research that they're stealing to present in their movies and their talks, why aren't they all following on this same conclusion? So what they have to do is they have to lie a little bit. And this is another one of those annoying things about creationists. They have to lie and say, well, we've only recently discovered how complicated this cell is. This is brand new. It's going to take a couple years, and once every biologist understands that cells are complicated, Darwinism will collapse. Dembski even said it was going to collapse within 5 years, 7 years ago. So here's the kind of thing they say. This is something that is very striking. Get on Google and search for Darwin protoplasm. And what you will find is nothing but intelligent design site. They are all saying exactly the same thing. Like Tom Bethel here, in Darwin's day, the cell was thought to be little more than a simple lump of protoplasm or containing a homogeneous transparent fluid. Jonathan Wells, who wrote The Politically Incorrect Guide to Darwinism and Intelligent Design, which was actually mistitled. There was an error at the printers. It should have been The Factually Incorrect Guide to Darwinism and Intelligent Design, has said the same thing. Darwin thought cells were mere blobs of protoplasm. It's part of their propaganda approach, is let's make everybody else look as stupid as we are, and then maybe they'll be a little bit more gullible. And so first thing I want to do here is I want to show you that this is wrong. Darwin certainly had no such simplistic idea of the cell. You can dig back in the literature pretty easily, and you know, Schneider, 1873, he's drawing cells up there. These are the first published illustrations of chromosomes. They knew about chromosomes in 1873. Fleming did a much better job. These are very nice pictures. All kinds of details of what's going on inside those cells. Nobody at that time had this idea that there was nothing in the cell but a homogeneous, clear solution. They knew that there was all kinds of interesting things going on there. There were people who were doing all kinds of exciting research. Camillo Golgi, Ramon Santiago y Cajal, all kinds of histologists were making names for themselves at this time by looking at cells and showing, hey, there's all kinds of cool stuff going on in here. We ought to watch it. And it wasn't as if Darwin was unaware of the literature. Okay, he died in 1882, so he may not have read Fleming's work. But he also published in 1882, and this is from Darwin's own work where he's publishing his studies in microscopy of plants. He's describing chloroplasts. He's describing how they move in the cell. He's looking at cytoplasmic streaming. So it's very, very silly to make this claim that Darwin thought cells were simple blobs. Okay, so they're relying on logical fallacies so far, and they're relying on lying about the history of science. What about this whole complexity issue, though? As I just said, we biologists will freely admit things are really, really complicated inside the cell. They're even more complicated when you have some training and understand the biology, unlike most of the creationists. So how do we explain that? Don't we have to resort to a creator? And we say, well, no, of course not. There's lots of things that are very complicated. I'll show you an example here. This is a photo from a beach up north, Rialto Beach in Washington State. It's one of my favorite places. I really recommend. Go ahead, take a vacation there. You'll love it. And this is a very common thing along beaches, even beaches in California. Driftwood. Have you ever looked at driftwood? You go on the beach, and I'm sure they bulldoze it away here, but in other states, it's left sitting there. You find these walls of driftwood between you and getting down to the beach. Real walls, very complicated walls. Look at all those logs just lying all over the place. This is, we can say, a wall. It has been constructed. Who did it? We know the answer. Natural processes did it. We don't need a designer to build this kind of wall. That what happens here is this is just the storm line. That storms come along, they push logs that are floating at sea up onto the shore, and this is the limit of where they push them, and they pile up there, and they make these very complicated long walls that run for miles and miles and miles, and are interesting places with all kinds of bizarre things going on in them. I mean, these are habitats for various invertebrates, for birds, all kinds of things live in here. Bacteria, of course, are thriving on it, and you get these complicated shapes. This is complex. You simply can't deny it. That's a very complex thing. If I turn the projector off, will you be able to draw it? No, because it's fairly detailed, all kinds of minutiae involved in building this kind of wall. On the other hand, we're familiar with this kind of wall. So this is also a wall. It's one that we can recognize that has a specific purpose that was built by human agents. And I'd have to say that of these two walls, which one is simpler? The human-built one. This is one of the things about agency, is that when we build things, we don't make them needlessly complex. We want to make them as simple and efficient as we can, unlike that driftwood wall. So there's a difference here. When we look at natural walls, what we discover is that natural things are built by chance and necessity. They're functionally unspecified. There's nothing that says that pile of driftwood is a wall. It just functions as a wall to us. But it's also got diverse other functions. And they all tend to be complex. In this sense, complex often means sloppy. But it's still complex. Artificial walls, on the other hand, are built with intent. They're functionally very specific. You don't just get a bunch of bricks and some mortar and you randomly throw it around to build a wall. If you want to build a wall, you build a wall. And that makes them relatively simple. So this is a mistake they're making. You can't use simple complexity as a measure of design. As another example, I know there are some academics here who are probably like me. You know, I start every school year and I go into my office and my desk is pristine and everything is neatly laid out. And if you want to see real complexity, come visit me around about December And suddenly everything is overwhelmed with complexity. There's books and papers everywhere. And I swear to you, it's not by intent. I don't plan it that way. What it is a lack of planning that leads to this kind of complexity.
You're listening to Beneath the Surface with Michael Slate, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. Today we're listening to a speech from P.Z. Myers. It's a speech he delivered to the Atheist Alliance International Convention in Burbank just at the beginning of October. It's a magnificent debunking of intelligent design. And we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll rejoin P.Z. in this speech. Welcome back. That was Archie Shepp with Attica Blues. We're going to rejoin P.Z. Myers now and the speech he gave to the Atheist Alliance International Convention in Burbank earlier in October. So let's get back to P.Z. now.
Okay, what about real biology? Something more interesting than a pile of driftwood. Can we find instances of complexity building up in organisms? And can we say whether it's a result of design or something else going on? And I'm just going to give you one example because I don't want to be in the way of the beer. And this is one of my favorite animals. This is a coanoflagellate. Coanoflagellates are really cool, simple little protists. So that's the first thing I have to tell you. This is a protist. It means it is typically a single-celled animal. And what it does is it just sits there in the water column, and it's got this thing called a flagellum, which the creationists just love. Okay, well, there's a flagellum there. And it whips around, and what it does is it generates vortexes of water currents that suck bacteria and other things that it might want to eat down toward that little collar of cilia that surround the flagellum. That's how it lives. It just slurps up the water, collects all the bacteria that stick to its collar, and it thrives. It does very well. This is a protist, and like it says there, it's not a metazoan. And a metazoan is simply things like us, multicellular animals. I think you would all agree with me that there is a difference in complexity between a protist and a metazoan, right? Okay, if you're going to disagree with me, I'd have to stop and we'd have to lecture for an hour to explain this, and that would get in the way of the beer, so I won't. So anyway, we're multicellular animals. What does that mean? That means we are made up of collections of cells, large collections of cells that have to do multiple things, messages back and forth, basically telling each other what they're supposed to do. So you can imagine there are messages flying around when you eat a candy bar. Insulin, you've all heard of that. We got to have this stuff that's flowing around that tells cells whether it's okay to take up sugars or not. It's part of the business of cooperation. We got important signals going on during development. So during development, cells are sticking together, and then they're making decisions like, should I be a liver or should I be a kidney? And the way they have to do this is they talk to each other and they recruit their neighbors. And they say, okay, I'm going to be a liver. All my neighbors around you here, you're supposed to be livers too, liver cells too. So let's get together and cooperate and build an organ. And if any cell around there happens to want to switch on the kidney genes, we'll boot him out or tell him very strongly that he has to switch. But it requires communication. So we've got cell-cell communication going on all over the place. Now, these are functions that we think of as going on in us, all right? We're multicellular. What about coanoflagellates? They're single-celled. They don't have to do that stuff. They all have this free life just floating around independently, each cell doing its own thing. So you'd think, well, this is something new that has evolved in us. And here's a surprise, it's not new, that coanoflagellates have a lot of the machinery that are involved in this process. For instance, I'll mention just one example here. There's a protein that was thought to be characteristic of multicellular organisms. Multicellular animals, and that's a receptor tyrosine kinase. Makes you sound smart when you say these polysyllabic biological terms, doesn't it? Anyway, receptor tyrosine kinase, what it is basically it's a protein that sits on cell surfaces, and it binds to proteins in the neighborhood, so it's one of those communication agents, and then on the inside it's got something called a tyrosine kinase, which sticks phosphate groups on other proteins and initiates a cascade of activity. So it's one of these cells that are involved in communication. It's getting signals from other cells, and it's telling the nucleus, telling the DNA what it's supposed to do. So this is what receives a signal, for instance, that, oh, my neighbors are all liver cells, so I'm going to activate these proteins, which will turn on liver genes, and we'll all be happy, and this will be a good neighborhood. We'll settle down and raise a family right here. That's what this is for. Where did that come from, you might ask? Well, it turns out coanoflagellates have receptor tyrosine kinases. it kind of blew a few people's minds way back when, because receptor tyrosine kinases were thought just to be found in animals, multicellular animals. This is a characteristic of multicellular animals. Coniflagellates are protists, they're not multicellular, yet they've got it. When they've analyzed this in some more detail, what they've discovered is an interesting history for this particular protein. How did you get this little protein? Well, if you look in plants and if you look in fungi, you find that they have tyrosine kinases, so they have the proteins that do that phosphorylation trick, and they're floating around inside the cell. And they have this other protein that sits on the surface called an epidermal growth factor. So it's a protein that's sitting on the surface and receives signals, but they're not tied together. And somewhere in the last common ancestor of coniflagellates and us metazoans, there was an accident, a little glitch in the duplication of this gene, and it ended up fused. This is like peanut butter and chocolate, okay? Once upon a time, peanut butter and chocolate came together, and what you got was something new, a brand new protein that can do some interesting new things in communications between cells. So now cells can have this little receptor on the surface that can recognize their neighbors and can initiate a bunch of changes on the inside, and all these wonderful new features could then evolve. This is just one step in all the features that we evolved, but of course it arose in a single-celled protist. Okay, so those are receptor tyrosine kinases. Labs have now taken apart coniflagellates. They've sequenced their genomes. They've pulled out all these interesting genes in there. And they found that there's a whole bunch of stuff that once upon a time we thought were unique only to multicellular animals. And there they are. They're inside coniflagellates. So the receptor tyrosine kinase I just mentioned, and they're the ones that signal switches in gene activity. They also found cadherins. Cadherins are really useful in all of us. This is glue, okay? I mentioned that you have to have glue that holds your cells together. This is a special selective glue that you can tighten up or release by changing levels of calcium. So it makes development very flexible. And there it is. It's there in coniflagellates. And they also have these things called integrins. Cells not only have to stick to other cells, but in us multicellular animals, we build complex internal environments. We secrete all kinds of proteins internally that make things like a cellular matrix, a protein matrix that cells can stick to. And they have special proteins dedicated to glomming on to these proteins and holding the whole structure together. And there they are in these protists. So the point is that we've got all this cool stuff going on inside. It's complicated, sure, but it's not as if a designer came along and said, well, we got to have multicellular animals, so we got to add all this machinery, all these tools, all these little fasteners and so forth to the genome so that they can stick together and build multicellular creatures. No, this was all stuff that was present earlier in single-celled animals. You might ask, what were the single-celled animals using it for? Well, it turns out that even if you're single-celled, it's useful to talk to your neighbors. You want to know what they're eating. Coniflagellates exhibit interesting behavior. Sometimes, for instance, they will clump together, and it's a more efficient way to get their flagella whirling away and draw in even more bacteria to eat. They also cooperate. They stick together when they go through diurnal cycles where they move up and down the water column. And again, what they do is they all pile together. They all aim their flagella in the same direction and acts like a little multi-motor motorboat and shoots it up to the surface or down deep, whichever way they're going. So all these things are working together in single-celled animals. The lesson is that when we see this stuff, when we see complicated things, whether it's integrins, whether it's bacterial flagella, whatever, we make a mistake when we look at it as if nature is an engineer, as if somebody has designed those for a specific purpose. What we find is this. Evolved organisms exhibit complexity because they are a product of those processes. What they are a product of is chance. So that's an important component. Let's just mix things up. The fact that an EGF and a tyrosine kinase once got together and fused, that initial event that fused those two genes together was a chance event. Then, of course, it was no longer chance when that actually conferred a selective advantage, and then selection could get to work and increase the likelihood of those individuals surviving. Other concepts that, if this were an Evo-Devo talk, and I could go on at length about them, we could talk about modularity. It turns out that many of these genes are working together in cooperative modules, like the circuits in a circuit board, to carry out various functions. So there's this complexity that's built in because they're trying to carry out fairly complex functions that are built up from simpler functions. And again, if you go to Radio Shack, many of you, I'm sure, went through this phase at least once, where you went to the Radio Shack and you just had to build a radio or something. And what do you find? You get all these little simple modules that don't do much. You stack them together and you get function out of it. That's what's going on in evolution. Of course, we were doing it by design. Evolution does it by chance. Multifunctionality is another component. Like I mentioned with the driftwood wall, it doesn't have a specific function. It's not there because it's supposed to make a wall. When we look at things like the receptor tyrosine kinases, they're not there because they have to make a liver. They're there just for a more general function of cell-cell communication. Incremental tinkering is an important one. Once you get this little piece that sort of works, you have to have more changes to increase its ability. Just adding a receptor tyrosine kinase to a single-celled protist doesn't turn it into me. There's a whole bunch of other features that had to evolve gradually over time by tinkering to eventually produce fully-fledged multicellular organisms with complicated patterns of communication within them. Another factor, of course, is contingency. We've inherited receptor tyrosine kinases. There's no particular reason why we need an EGF tied to a tyrosine kinase to carry out this function. And as we look at biology, we find many other cell signaling molecules that use other modularities to carry out their function. So in part, this is chance, again, that has established this particular set of molecules in our ancient ancestors, and we still retain them. All of these then, of course, are shaped by functional constraints. Stuff that doesn't work, that interferes with working, gets culled out by natural selection. Okay, so that's one message I want to get across to you is, okay, the metaphor is wrong. Complexity doesn't mean it's design. And even though we have complexity, we have other paths to arrive at complexity. But I don't want to leave you with just that because, you know, I've just been talking all sciencey stuff at you, right? And some of you won't remember that. And others of you will say, oh, well, that was really boring. I knew that already. Let me just mention some of the things. So one of the things we have to do as communicators is we have to carry out something that gets the message across to people. And there are metaphors out there that are useful. And there are words out there that are useful. And I want to introduce you to a really useful word, one of my favorite words to describe evolution, development in the genome, and that's kipple. Any of you have read Philip K. Dick? You must have. Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Yeah, oh, it's a classic. It's the book that was made into the movie Blade Runner and so forth. And Philip K. Dick was crazy, but he came up with all kinds of interesting ideas. And here's this word he came up with. It's called kipple. That what you find is that when you look at natural things, they tend to get very messy over time. He's basically restating laws of thermodynamics here, but kipple's a little catchier than thermodynamics. And so what he's saying is, it's like my desk at my office. My desk is accumulating kipple. It's not because gnomes come in and do it. It's because chance, because this lack of intent, the lack of intelligence, tends to accumulate these sorts of sloppinesses that can produce a very complicated outcome. So kipple's a word I want more people to use. When you talk about the human genome, for instance, just remember it's 95% kipple. And then one other concept I'll close with, and this is another word that I really like, and it's going to be very much out of character for me because this is a religious word. This is a really useful religious word, and it comes from one of the good religions, however. It comes from Bokanonism, which is a creation of the author Kurt Vonnegut. And he came up with this term, Grand Falloon. If you wish to study a Grand Falloon, just remove the skin of a toy balloon. Isn't that pretty? What a Grand Falloon is, it's a group of people who outwardly choose or claim to have a shared identity or purpose, but whose mutual association is actually completely meaningless. And he gives the classic, the canonical example of a Grand Falloon is this one from his book, Cat's Cradle, Hoosiers. Is there anybody from Indiana here? All right. Hey there, Hoosiers. I lived in Indiana for a year. I get to be a semi-honorary Hoosier. You're all people who are in a group. We can categorize you. We could pull all the Hoosiers out of this room and have them stand up here and get their picture taken, all this kind of stuff, and you wouldn't know each other. You really don't have much association with each other, but you do have that linkage. But ultimately, it's a kind of meaningless linkage. I think that's what we're dealing with when we listen to creationists talk about design. Design to a creationist is what a Hoosier is to us. It's a completely artificial label that we've put on a set of phenomena, and we're saying that this links them all together. But they haven't defined design. They haven't given us a methodological process for understanding design. They're just making it up as they go along. So that's the context we have to keep that in. So I've left you with two brand new words, kipple and Grand Falloon, and you'll probably remember those after you remember receptor tyrosine kinase. Thank you.
All right, you've been listening to P.Z. Myers in a speech he delivered at the Atheist Alliance International Convention back in early October out in Burbank. And it's a debunking of intelligent design. And you're listening to Beneath the Surface with Michael Slate. And we will be taking a short break and be right back.
I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. I had confessed to myself all along, tracer of life, poetry, trends. that awareness consciousness poems that screamed of pain and the origins of pain and death had blanketed my tablets, and therefore my friends, brothers, sisters, in-laws, outlaws, and besides. They already knew. But Brother Torres, common ancient bloodline Brother Torres, is dead. I had said I wasn't gonna write no more poems like this. I had said I wasn't gonna write no more words down about people kicking us when we're down, about racist dogs that attack us and drive us down, drag us down and beat us down. But the dogs are in the street. The dogs are alive, and the terror in our hearts has scarcely diminished. It has scarcely brought us the comfort we suspected. The recognition of our terror and the screaming release of that recognition has not removed the certainty of that knowledge. How could it? The dogs, rabid, foaming with the energy of their brutish ignorance, stride the city streets like robot gunslingers and spread death as night lamps flash crude reflections from gun butts and police shields. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. But the battlefield has oozed away from the stilted debates of semantics, beyond the questionable flexibility of primal screaming. The reality of our city, jungle streets and their gestapos has become an attack on home, life, family, philosophy, total. It is beyond a question of the advantages of didactic niggerisms. The motherfucking dogs are in the street. In Houston, maybe someone said Mexicans were the new niggers. In LA, maybe someone said Chicanos were the new niggers. In Frisco, maybe someone said Orientals were the new niggers. Maybe in Philadelphia and North Carolina, they decided they didn't need no new niggers. I had said I wasn't gonna write no more poems like this, but the dogs are in the street. It's a turnaround world where things are all too quickly turned around. It was turned around so that right looked wrong. It was turned around so that up looked down. It was turned around so that those who marched in the street with Bibles and signs of peace became enemies of the state and risk to national security, so that those who questioned the operations of those in authority on the principles of justice, liberty, and equality became the vanguard of a communist attack. It became so you couldn't call a spade a motherfucking spade. Brother Torres is dead. The Wilmington 10 are still incarcerated. Ed Davis, Ronald Reagan, James Hunt, and Frank Rizzo are still alive, and the dogs are in the motherfucking street. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. I made a mistake.
Gil Scott Heron, Jose Campos Torres, a song that was really powerful when it was first released back in the mid-70s and even more powerful and relevant today. Joining us now to talk about October 22nd, the National Day of Protest Against Police Brutality, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation is Carl Dix. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Michael.
Sure. You know, Carl, we're sitting out here. I've been doing a lot of reading about police brutality and a lot of it's going to meetings and discussions that people have been having throughout the city around this. And one thing has really struck me. When you look at the way what's going on, there really is, we've been talking about an epidemic of police brutality for a very long time. And police brutality and murder. And, you look at New York, Chicago, the Bay Area here in L.A., there really is a killing ground that's going on. They talk about killing fields in other places. This really is a killing fields in all these major cities. Here in L.A., the sheriff's killed 13 people in 1 year. So far, the year ain't up. And they after they killed the first 10, the sheriff came and said, we better investigate how fast we look into this stuff, or maybe we'll have our shooting experts investigate some stuff. But then a couple of days later, the following weekend, the sheriff's murdered 3 more people within 14 hours. You look at this, and it is certainly no exaggeration to talk about an epidemic. And also, it's no exaggeration to say it really raises a major, major challenge and puts a major weight on people who are disgusted by all this, who do not want to see this happen anymore, to stand up and do something. And you get numbers like this, and you can't. I was at this one program on Sunday where people started talking about rogue cops, this, that. This is no rogue cop. These kinds of things, these are no aberrations. This is not a break from the norm. What do you think about that, man?
Yeah, what it comes down to, first off, that was a very good lead-in to this segment, because the dogs are not only in the street, they're being unleashed to beat people down and keep people in line. It's an undeniable point that this is just a part of keeping people in line by brutal and even murderous force, and that's a question of the police playing their role within this system. And the numbers that you speak of in L.A. are horrifying. But then as you go across the country, the same kind of thing is happening. Memphis, Tennessee, I had a conversation with somebody there. The police have killed 5 people already this year in Memphis, which is a much smaller area than Los Angeles. I mean, and then there's just the everyday indignity that the police inflict on people. Because here in New York, last year, the police stopped and frisked over 500,000 people. Over 85% of them were black or Latino, and over 90% of them weren't doing anything wrong when they were accosted by the cops, but still they were harassed, humiliated, abused, and sometimes even worse, beaten down and all like that. This year, they're on a pace to stop and frisk 600,000 people. So, I mean, they're even escalating this kind of stuff. So from the everyday indignity to the murderous reality of what you've been talking about in terms of L.A., this is really outrageous, it is unacceptable, and it must be stopped. And that gives October 22nd this year even more importance. You know, because a lot of people going into this year were talking about, well, is America turning the corner on the brutality and the racist degradation that it brings down on black people with the first black president moving into office? And if anything, what the majority of black people have been up against has intensified over this year, and hammering home that no, this was not something that was going to be easily taken apart or even taken apart because of the election of Barack Obama. This is something that's built into the fabric of this system, and it's going to take, in my view, as a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party, it's going to take a revolution to uproot this brutality and all of the oppressions brought down on black people, as well as everything else foul about this system. And along with that, right now, a movement of resistance is very much needed. This cannot be taken as just the way it is or what people have to put up with, because if you can put up with all of this that's brought down, then where will it go next?
Well, let me ask you this, you know, because there's a question. I mean, even in terms of what you're saying about it's going to take a revolution to actually deal with this. This is one of the things that Bob Avakian, who's the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, has talked about often, where he draws sort of a comparison, a similarity. He draws out the similarity between the KKK lynch mobs and terror that had gone on in decades past, and the role of the police today. What does this say about this kind of terror, the systematic terror, as well as frankly, the randomness where you don't know, you know, you can go out for it like Michael Bayoun in Inglewood. You can go out for a hamburger after playing video games with your friends on a Sunday night, go out for a hamburger and end up shot to death in front of your car. You know, and there's a certain amount of, it seems there's this link between the lynch mob terror in the past and the role of the police today. What do you think this says about the role of the police in the society?
Well, what it says is, when you look at the lynch mobs, what were they doing? They were actually enforcing the white supremacy of that period and keeping black people in their place. And it's the same thing with the role of the police today. And it isn't even just that they enforce inequality and the unjust laws of the system, but they also throw out the system's own laws and constitution to keep people under its thumb. And it really says something when this is what is held out for the youth especially, you know, because the youth are the future. And what kind of future are they saying when what the youth constantly get is police on them 24/7 all the time? Kids telling us up in Harlem that it's not unusual for them to get stopped and frisked by the cops several times on their way from their house to go see a friend or to go to the market or even to go to school, you know. It's a question of people being kept in their place and people being held down and forced to put up with the injustice, the inequality, and the degradation that the system brings down. And that's why, I guess, Avakian has also made the point about, speaking to this randomness point, that for many black youth, it's a question of having a death sentence hanging over you, something that could be enforced at any time. And that's what people are up against, and it's part of the thing of keeping people in line. And it's really a challenge to recognize that for what it is, to not toss this off, like you were saying, isolated incidents or a few rogue cops. You know, like somebody did a study on this, of how many police actually carry out this kind of brutality and degradation, and then how many other cops back them up when they do it. And what it comes down to is that you've got not a few rotten apples in a barrel, but a barrel of rotten apples.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to Beneath the Surface with Michael Slate, and I'm Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party about October 22nd and the struggle against police brutality and murder. I want to remind listeners that you're listening to Beneath the Surface with Michael Slate, and I'm Michael Slate, and today we're talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party about police brutality, the fight against police brutality, and later we're going to be joined by Age from the October 22nd Coalition in Los Angeles. We're going to take a quick break and be right back.
Only when nature doesn't take its natural toll am I worried with the human soul. Some people think that they are in their rights when on command they take a black man's life. Now let me give a rundown on how I feel. If it ain't natural, then it ain't real.
Welcome back to Beneath the Surface with Michael Slate. We're going to rejoin our discussion on police brutality, but I wanted to let you know, first of all, that that was the invocation to Attica Blues, Archie Shepp's Attica Blues. And that voice you hear speaking on there, that narration, that was William Kunstler. Beautiful, beautiful piece leading into a very powerful piece of music, Attica Blues. The entire album is one that's definitely worth picking up and listening to time and time again. So now let's rejoin our conversation with Carl Dix of the Revolutionary Communist Party about the fight against police brutality, October 22nd, the National Day of Protest against Police Brutality, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation. Now, Carl, you're talking about this kind of the enforcing, you know, and what you're getting at is it actually, there is this thing about the police in the role of enforcing the system. It's and you know, a lot of times people just think, okay, well, if you get to the point where you recognize the systemic role of the police, then there's a question of, well, they're just enforcing unjust laws. But actually, the thing that you're pointing to is they go way beyond that. They actually even break their own laws in this. I mean, I know out here, you know, people are shot a lot of times for suspicion of breaking parole or for running away. You know, none of the things that people get stopped for are actually, one, crimes that deserve that get the death sentence, and certainly not execution on the spot, which is what happens very often.
I mean, yeah, and it's just, you go through the excuses that have been put forward for exonerating killer cops. You know, somebody had a candy bar and they thought it was a gun. Somebody had a wallet and they thought it was a gun. Somebody had keys and they thought it was a gun. And it's real clear that what you're talking about here isn't just police zealously enforcing the law, but going above and beyond that and tossing out the law to actually enforce the conditions that people in their millions have to put up with in this capitalist system. That's especially something that's targeted at oppressed nationalities, and it is really a challenge to see it for what it is, you know, to go beyond the normal explanations of when it does pierce through to a point where people have to see that it happened. Oh, well, that's just an isolated incident. That was just a bad cop. It's not really like that. No, it is actually really like that. It's everyday life for large sections of society. And the thing about October 22nd is the day for people to come out and stand against all of that, both those who live their lives under the guns and billy clubs of these brutal, murdering cops, but also those who don't experience that 24/7 but recognize it for the injustice that it is and want to be a part of stopping it. And that's part of the importance of October 22nd, bringing together that broad array of people to say this is unjust, it's unacceptable, and it must be stopped. And, you know, as one of the co-founders of this, one thing that I think is very important this year is that it's not just, again, we're out here noting the fact that police brutalize and even murder people, but something that we say in a statement that was in Revolution newspaper, the revolution we need and the leadership we have. And in a section of it, it says, the days when this system can do what it wants to do to people here in this country and around the world, when people are not inspired and organized to stand up and resist and to build up the strength to end this madness once and for all, those days must be gone, and they can be gone. And we want to work to bring that to life this year on October 22nd, and even beyond that, in terms of building resistance to this outrage as part of unleashing people to fight the power and transform themselves and others for revolution.
Now, Carl, tell me this, because this is a question that comes up often, and it's something that I think is really, you know, it's very, very problematic, because basically what ends up happening is a lot of times, and I know a friend of mine just wrote an article about the surge in violence between youth killing each other, and a lot of times the media will run this out as sort of a veiled and not so veiled justification for we need the police. Look, these kids are just killing each other. It's not so much the problem that the police are murdering people, but kids are just going buck wild in the streets, you know. And this is sort of really it turns seems to me that's very much a turning the victims into victimizers.
Yeah, and see, I would say two things to that. The first thing I would say is, well, okay, that is a real problem, but it is still a problem that the police are murdering and brutalizing people, especially the youth, and getting away with it. And nothing should be allowed to push that aside. Then in terms of looking at the situation of many of our youth are into and the way in which they are fighting amongst themselves and even killing each other for nothing, or at least for nothing any good, again, we have to look at what is the cause of that. Because the frustration and hopelessness that's got a lot of our youth into that actually stem from situations that they did not create and that them and their parents and their communities are not responsible for. It's this system and the way in which it works that is responsible for creating that hopelessness and that frustration. You know, because who sucked the jobs out of the inner cities across this country? That wasn't the masses who were forced to live in those inner cities and to deal with those conditions of, you know, the lack of any legitimate way to survive and raise a family. It was this capitalist system in search of the highest profits that moved those jobs, you know, to the far out suburbs and even halfway around the world. It's not the youth in that area that wrecked the education system that, you know, they had to go with. It was, again, the system that did that. And the fact is that the doors that are open to millions and millions of youth in the inner cities are not the doors to higher education and meaningful jobs at living wages, but the doors to the prison system or to the military. And again, that comes back to, for me, the need for revolution, because a system which offers so many of our youth no better future or fate than crime or punishment or to become a mindless killing machine for the system itself, that again comes back to a reason to get rid of the system through revolution.
You know, Carl, I got to say, too, I'm gonna invite Age from the October 22nd Coalition to join us in just a minute. But I got to say, too, one of the things I saw in Revolution newspaper that was very, very, really, very sharply put and I thought really grabbed a lot of people was the idea that, I think it's been borne out every time it's happened, when people raise this and they raise this excuse of calling, you know, as the situation among youth, and I think what you're getting at is really the heart of it. But I also think that there's a point here of if you think calling the cops or getting more cops or that proves the need for the cops, you know, to deal with this, if you think that's actually going to help, you got to be crazy. Because if you look at this, look at what they have done. You're bringing in more repression. Out here we had Jamil Shaw supposedly killed by, you know, a Latino gangster. That's the thing, although nobody's ever, you know, there's never been a trial yet. There's never been any of this. But then that was immediately used to sort of launch a campaign against immigrants at large, you know. And this kind of thing happens again and again and again. You know, and it's, I know in Chicago, the whole thing there with the national media made a big thing out of, you know, the young man that was killed in a school fight and used it. Then it was used to justify all kinds of, you know, curfews and increased police harassment and surveillance and all these other things. And this is just people need to just say, no, this is not acceptable. Now, let me, you can comment on that in a minute, but I want to bring Age from the October 22nd Coalition in, because we got just about, oh, I don't know, maybe 9 minutes, and I wanted to give him a chance to talk about the October 22nd day here in L.A., and actually there's going to be a march, a rally, and also something both of you, well, he hasn't spoken yet, but we need to remind people is wear black wherever you are. The Coalition has been calling on wear black. Show what your stand is on this. Age, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Okay. Hey, Age.
What's going on, Carl?
Well, soon, October 22nd is going on.
Yeah, man. Gotta get excited.
Why don't you tell us, Age, about October 22nd here in L.A.? First off, what is the situation here in L.A., and what actually is planned for here in L.A.?
Well, I mean, I hope that everybody who's listening would know is that this has been a really intense year as far as not only police murder across the city, across the county, but also just intense repression and criminalization of youth has been through the roof in Los Angeles and, of course, across the nation. As you mentioned earlier, there's the 13 killings by the Sheriff's Department alone. That doesn't include murders by the LAPD. That doesn't include murders by Inglewood PD or various other, you know, police stations around the county. And it also doesn't include any of the areas in the Inland Empire where a lot of working class people have moved to in the last several years, such as San Bernardino and Riverside, where there's been a rash of killings by the police. You know, also with situations of people like Alex Sanchez, where you see the intense repression of community voices. And then these are, you know, laws, these where they're sending away teens for years and years and years in jail for petty things like graffiti right now. There was the recent cases all over the news of a kid getting 4 years. I know another one who got 8 years for it. And, you know, things like this where they're sending kids, locking kids away for more and more years, you know, trying to shut down voices in the community of people who are speaking out against it and still constantly getting away with murder. It's been a very grave situation. I think one of the things that I noticed is that, you know, whereas before it was, you know, it would take national media or take major media to get information out. And so the police would simply try to hide their murders. Now, knowing that they can't really hide them when people have all their cell phones and various other technologies, they've moved to this excuse of fearing for their lives. And it's like the catchphrase now where they're able to get away with murder just because they simply, you know, quote unquote, feared for their life, which would completely justify the killing of Amadou Diallo in New York, where, you know, there's numerous cases, and in almost all the cases we deal with are murders like that.
Well, look at what they've done already. We started this year, and I think, Carl, you might have even been on the show around this time. We started this year out with the murder of Oscar Grant up in the Bay Area, you know, filmed by so many people, you know, outraged so many people. Now we get a judge in Oakland on Friday making a ruling that says that Meserly, the cop that killed Oscar Grant, that he's going to be, his trial will be removed from Alameda County, taken someplace else. You know, they're doing the Simi Valley. They're doing the removal of the cops that, you know, the Amadou Diallo cops that were tried up in upstate New York. All these things that resulted in acquittals. You know, and now he says, and he turns around and he says it's because, he blames it on the people. He says because people were mad, they were angry, they were excited, they were protesting too much, and then therefore they couldn't have a trial of this killer cop who's caught on video doing the thing. And, you know, you really have to say what's going on here? And I think the point that you're making is that both of you have been making, that this is unacceptable. You know, so what is happening here, Age? And actually, I'd even say, in Inglewood, I'd say, you know, look, they just had a report after killing all these five people in a year. They killed these five people, and this is, you know, everybody's familiar with Inglewood from way back, although it was just also named a model American city, right? And they had an independent review of the police. The city got it and now refuses to show it, even to their own Citizen Oversight Committee, for all those people that think Citizen Oversight Committees are the answer. You know, they refuse to say anything. There's absolutely no, it's stonewalling everything because the police must be protected, and the job that they do is essential to the functioning of the system. What is the plan for October 22nd here?
Well, here in Los Angeles, I mean, specifically speaking to what you're talking about with the rash of murders in Inglewood, as we've seen over the last couple of years, and specifically this last year or two where it's been a heavy increase, we wanted to take it. It's been 13 years we've marched through downtown Los Angeles. This year we decided, because of how the intense reaction from the community and people actually standing up and fighting back against these murders, that we wanted to take it to the communities where it's been happening a lot. So the march this year is going to be going from Florence and Crenshaw in South Central L.A., and it's going to be gathering at 12 noon at Florence and Crenshaw, and the march will begin at 2 p.m. We're going to be marching straight north on Crenshaw Boulevard up to Lamert Park, which is at Crenshaw and Vernon, where there's going to be a rally held with speakers from different organizations, performers, musicians, as well as numerous family members and friends of people who've been killed by the police who are going to get their chance to tell the real side of the story, which is extremely important because, as we've seen, the media does nothing but cover it up when the police are out there committing these crimes. And as we see, they're not getting justice through the so-called justice system because they're just giving the police a green light to kill as they please. And the media is backing them up in that. So this is the time that people need to come out and to hear these real stories. And, you know, please be out there, Florence and Crenshaw, and see us at Lamert Park.
And wear black no matter where you are. I'm going to give each of you a chance for closing comments. Carl, anything you'd like to say?
Well, I think the thing that I want to say is that this is really unacceptable. Just everything from the horrific numbers of people who are killed by the police and then the police get away scot-free with that, no punishment, you know, none of that, down to the everyday indignity and brutality of being accosted by cops, you know, everywhere you go in your neighborhood, all of this coming down. It is really unacceptable, it is illegitimate, and it must be stopped, and October 22nd must be a day of showing that determination to do it and moving from there to build a movement of resistance that goes on it. I'm glad that Michael brought in the Wear Black, because that's an important way that people can mark the day. There needs to be both an ocean of black moving through the streets and cities across the country, but also people wearing black, you know, everywhere they happen to be that day.
All right, Carl, thank you very much. Age, any closing comments?
It's October 22nd, the 14th year in a row that, you know, people across the country are going to be given a chance to take the streets against police brutality and murder, against the criminalization of youth, against repression, and, of course, against the intense targeting of immigrants and criminalization of South Asians and Muslims.
All right, and Age, you can get in touch with October 22nd here by writing to who? Quick.
You can hit us up at October22nd_LA@yahoo.com, or you can call us at area code 323-446-7459.
All right, that about does it for our show today, and I want to thank P.Z. Myers for letting us broadcast his speech, the speech he gave to the Atheist Alliance International Convention earlier this month. I also want to thank Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and Age from the October 22nd Coalition in Los Angeles for appearing on the show and talking about police brutality, police murdering black and Latino youth, and the struggle to stop this, what can only be described as a crime against humanity. If you want to take part in October 22nd, you can get hold of the organization at october22.org. That'll tell you where the demonstrations are happening. And then also, if you want to get involved, you can just wear black on Thursday, October 22nd. Show the world that you're taking a stand against this. I'm Michael Slate, the host and producer of Beneath the Surface with Michael Slate. And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And we're going to go out with a song from The Clash. It's called Police on My Back. We're going to play that out, and I think that's extremely appropriate for the show we've been doing today. So until next time, take care.